One very interesting thing to me at this period is that there's so little reference to either the term priest or sacrifice in the early Christian literature. Not only the Jews made central in much of their thinking the offering of sacrifice in the temple carried out by an official priesthood, but those two words, both sacrifice and priest, were very common in all the pagan religions of the time. But the practice, in any literal sense, there's no reference to a Christian priest or to Christian priesthood, except once more, perhaps, in metaphor. That shows a way the independence of the Christian development. You might have thought, with the synagogue on the one hand and the pagan temple on the other, there was nothing necessary but just for them to adapt at all. They'd change from Saturday to Sunday and have a great big Bible school and have a formal ceremony. But Paul doesn't sound as though there's anything like as orderly as a synagogue service. I can't make out whether Paul's type of church would seem more offensive to a Jew and more disorderly and irregular to a Jew, or more irregular to an ordinary modern Christian. Both of them would find it very, very irregular, or shall I say informal. One other thing I might say, there's no reference to any presiding officer. Now, you know what we would say if anything, if a modern church had any of this kind of stuff. We'd say, why doesn't the minister do something about it? Or why don't the presbytery get together and stop all this? Paul was annoyed at what went on. Didn't approve of it. Not only when they overate at the Eucharist, but also when they all talked at once. And too many of them spoke with tongues, and too few of them talked with the understanding. But there's no possible suggestion that all is the fault of the presiding officer. And the reason is, I think, that there wasn't any presiding officer. A very informal, democratic type of volunteer contribution. Oral, over-oral, from our point of view. Well, is that all right? Is that a intelligible picture of, no matter how little we might want to reproduce it today, of how it's likely that this enthusiastic movement fell naturally into collective gatherings physically, I mean, together with one another, and into natural expression. I think it's very well for me to emphasize once more to a partly Quaker audience that there's no reference to silence. Yes?
Well, do you think that in spite of the Rothenstaufen aspects of the service, it was more sophisticated, nevertheless, in the kind of Bible Belt revivalism that we know today, so that if we think of it, you know, if we draw too close an analogy, that would be misleading. I think it had more spiritual depth. Do you think it had more sophistication of intellectual sophistication?
Well, that's my next question. I'm still talking on the explanation, and you can begin answering right away. I want to know whether worship appears to have been an occasion of intelligent, self-directed thinking and commitment that goes with thinking, or whether it was much more emotional than thoughtful. Is that a fair distinction to make?
Yes. That's what I was asking.
Would we have to recognize two levels of thought? The ordinary human level and that which comes through the intuition of the divine?
Yes, and you're speaking out of thought, not emotion. Yeah? And I have no doubt that the word revelation that's used was sometimes thought to be of a concrete idea injected, one knows not from where, unless from God, into the mind of the worshipper and then by him transmitted orally so that all could share. So that from one point of view it was it had a concrete content, thought content, idea content. I think that a man like Paul could hardly have lived long in his private or public devotions without that element entering in, no matter how emotional he was, and I think he was pretty emotional too, but I think this could enter in. Everyone, do you want to have any idea on in what area of thinking that that revelation beyond the human level might have come? I use my category. Would it have to do with the second coming of the Lord? Would it have to do about moral insight, right and wrong, and useful and unuseful behavior in the Church of Corinth? When Paul says, I received by revelation, is he probably thinking of something fairly specific?
My thought goes back to, I think it's Galatians 2:20, where Paul says, I live yet not I, Christ liveth in me.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the thought, the deeper thought, the intuitional thought, the revelation that comes, suggest to us that we are living in a, shall I say, a false sense of selfhood, that we have to realize that there is that of God seeking expression in us and through us?
Quite sure that Paul would feel that. We have quite a question whether Paul represented a characteristic Christian position. There's an awful lot of prosy people that for whom that's not so simple. And a lot of people for whom that is simple that have less intellectual control than Paul had, or less native intellectual sense. So that Paul perhaps stands in a middle place rather more favorable than the extremes. Yes? That's rather the interpretation, though, Paul's interpretation of the source of his, of this idea that he's pronounced. Now, one of the things that he may have learned from the Lord was that, well, it'll be interesting to go through his letter, but as he said, the Lord told him. The Lord told him once that my strength is sufficient for thee. He was praying about this thorn in the flesh. And that's what the Lord told him. And so he says, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Well, there's something he got. That's just one little thing that occurs to me. I say you ought to go through Paul's letters and see. I'm not quite sure whether he doesn't think that if the Lord has told him that people that were married should not separate. He refers to that in the 7th chapter. Now, whether he means the Lord told him by way of his knowledge of what Jesus said on earth, you never can quite be sure whether Paul is quoting Jesus as reported by his first disciples or quoting the Lord, the living Lord, as he speaks to Paul right now.
make any suggestions that is of a form of worship. Jesus didn't make any suggestions, did he?
I don't think he did. I think he assumed that they would still offer sacrifice at the temple and attend the synagogue and engage in private prayer and perhaps in collective prayer. Remember, he says, when you bring your gift to the altar, he said something about hoping you wouldn't have to flee on the Sabbath day. If you connect the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, that you do partly with worship, not exclusively. He does say in one place, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst. Is that worship? Not necessarily. We apply it to worship. Isn't it, maybe it is worship when you talk about spiritual fellowship. When a dozen Christians happen to be together, not necessarily with intention of worshiping, then in a sense, Christ is with me.
We interpret it as worship.
And we do. And I don't say we're wrong at all, no. But you're asking me whether Jesus anticipated special kind of worship. Maybe I haven't thought of all the possible answers.
What about what he said to the woman at the well?
Yes, true.
He
talked about the Jews and the Samaritans. And then he says, in the end, there'll be a time when you'll worship God neither there on that mountain nor here in this Jerusalem mountain, but worship him in spirit and truth, whatever that means. And there, of course, we're dealing with a reporter who is himself very spiritually minded and who is quite free in the way he puts his thought in the mouth of Jesus. More free, I think, than the other gospel writers. Yes?
I'd like to know some more about speaking in tongues. Where does it derive from? And is it still used today in any place?
Yes, there are people that profess to speak with tongues. And there have been primitive peoples all over the world in all kinds of religions that have done what I think was very similar. That is, under an emotional pressure, made sounds which were not articulate words in any familiar language, but were understood by themselves and by people of their group as being a divine inspiration. Now, since that is recorded in the New Testament, Christian people almost succeed in imitating it in certain communities. And it is practiced by certain sects today. Whether they ever would practice it or ever would connect it with this, if it hadn't been, that had been recorded. Now, I think there are other emotional expressions by Christians, irrational, that do not happen to be mentioned in the New Testament, and which are also interpreted by the modern worshiper as being a sign of... I've been at revival meetings where they didn't speak with tongues, but where they danced around in a way which was felt to be the expression of the Spirit and was so interpreted by the sympathetic members of the group. So I think the fact it's recorded has something to do with the perpetuating of it in professedly loyal and slavishly imitative Christian groups. I don't think you'll learn much about the primitive phenomenon by going to these particular places. And I wouldn't be able to give you a name and address just now as to where you could conveniently see it. There are no doubt people here that can. Yes.
Let's try a little broader answer.
A little louder, please, sir.
Maybe a little broad, the question, but I get the impression that the type of worship you're describing is chiefly characterized by